ओमज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानाञ्जनशलाकाय चक्षुरोन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः। नमः ॐ विष्णुपादाय कृष्णपृष्ठाय भूतले श्रीमते भक्तिवेदान्त स्वामी इति नामिने। नमस्ते सरस्वती देवे गौरवाणी प्रचारिणे निर्विशेष शून्यवादी पाश्चात्यदेशतारिणे वाञ्छाकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्यैव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः। जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधार श्रीवासादि गौरभक्तवृन्द। हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे हरे, हरे राम हरे राम 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 हरे हरे। हरे कृष्णा, थैंक ऑल ऑफ यू फॉर कमिंग हियर। माताजी आई सीक योर ब्लेसिंग सो दैट आई कैन स्पीक समथिंग। Thank you for gracing us. Feel free to make any comments or corrections whenever you feel. So I'll speak on the topic of, does God laugh at our plans? And I'll speak this in three main parts. First is, we'll talk about the intelligence and how intelligence is to be used in Krishna's service, and planning is an aspect of using the intelligence. Then second, I'll talk about how the use of the intelligence is affected by the three modes and how that affects our planning capacity. And then lastly, I'll talk about how that intelligence can be used for planning and for service, for the service of Krishna. So I'll speak in about, we have till 12:30, so I'll speak about 30 to 40 minutes, then we'll have some question answers. We'll have maybe one or two breaks in between, depending on how the session moves forward. So, this title, Does God Laugh at Our Plans, comes from a common saying. If you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans. And this has been said by many people. Currently, it is attributed to the American comedian Woody Allen. So he said that, and some devotees have also quoted that. Now, the idea behind this saying, at one level it's humorous, at another level it's philosophical. If we think that our plans are based on the assumption that we are controllers, and that things will work out the way we want them to, then that is quite a high level of presumptuousness. Just like sometimes the child says, child has sometimes built some sand castles, and a child says, okay, mommy, no, I'm going to build a new home for you now. Child, okay, I'll make that plan. And the child may be able to build some sand castles, but building a home is a big thing. So if the child says, I'll do that, the mother may laugh. That laugh is not about of sadism. Not that the mother wants the child's plan to get frustrated. But the child doesn't know what all is involved in getting things done. So basically, from the Bhagavad Gita's perspective, if we consider that when we think that we are the doer, we are the karta, so then that is where the illusion comes in. So I'll take four verses from the Bhagavad Gita which talk about this conception of the doer. And then we will see what exact understanding is. Recently I was at a program, and one devotee told me that if you hear this verse, which is the most well-known verse about doership from the Bhagavad Gita, we often quote in our classes. Does anyone know? Okay, but we are not the, that's true, but that is detachment from fruits. We are not the doers. Those who think they are doers are an illusion.
most of you know the verse 3.27 prakriti kriyamanani gunai karmani sarvashah ahankara vimudhatma kartahamiti manyate. Material nature is doing everything. Gunai karmani sarvashah. And ahankara vimudhatma, because of ahankara, because of thinking that I am the doer, kartahamiti manyate, because of ahankara, one thinks I am a doer. So now what exactly does this verse mean? Recently I was doing a program and I asked that devotee that, you know, if we hear this verse and he says we are not the doers, so what thoughts come in your mind? There is one devotee who is known to be very lethargic and apathetic. He said, if I am not the doer, why should I do anything? If I am not the doer, why should I do anything at all? But actually, going back to the verse that Mataji quoted just now, karmanyavadi karaste ma phaleshu katajana ma karma phala heturbhur ma te sangostva karmani. Krishna also says, do not be attached to not doing your work. So, although we are not the doer, Krishna is saying that doesn't mean that we are not meant to do anything. We are definitely meant to do. So, this is one verse which talks about doership. It says, material nature is doing things. To think we are the doer is illusion. But at the end of the Bhagavad Gita, in 18.63, Krishna tells Arjuna, now you deliberate and decide what you want to do. Vimrishaita dasheshena yathechasi tatha kuru. Deliberate and then decide. Kuru. Now, karta and kuru come from the same roots. So, here Krishna is telling you have to be the doer. You have to do. Do as you desire. So Krishna is telling Arjuna that you are the doer and you choose what you do. And 10 verses later, 18.73, Arjuna responds by saying, Karishye vachanam tava, I will do your will. So, that means Krishna tells Arjuna, you are the doer, do what you desire. And Arjuna says, yes, I will do what you desire. So, Krishna acknowledges Arjuna's free will, do as you desire. And Arjuna responds by saying, I will do as you desire. So, voluntarily, Arjuna is handing over his will to Krishna or harmonizing his will with Krishna. So, if the Bhagavad Gita says earlier, we are not the doers, then why is it telling Arjuna to be the doer? And why is Arjuna saying, I will be the doer? So this is resolved in the 18th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, verses 13 to 16 or 14 to 16. They talk about various different five factors involved in action. And there Krishna says, I won't go into the five factors right now, because we don't want to analyze action, we want to analyze planning right now. So, there Krishna says, Tatraivam sati kartaram atmanam kevalam duya pashyati akritabuddhitvan nasa pashyati durmatihi. Therefore, one who thinks, I am the sole doer, that person is an illusion. Atmanam kevalam duya. So, the atma is the doer, but one who thinks the atma alone is the doer, that is apashyatya akrita buddhitvan. That person's intelligence is not very developed, and therefore nasa pashyati durmatihi. That person doesn't see the full picture. See, thinks some part of it they're seeing, but the whole part they're not seeing at all. So we are definitely the doers, but we are not the sole doers. So to think we are the sole doers is the illusion. I had a realization about how I am not the sole doer recently. I've been a tour for about 2.5 months. So I was in Silicon Valley a couple of months ago. And I spoke on one topic, the same topic, at four different places. I spoke in Google, Intel, Stanford, and Salesforce. The topic that devotees had chosen was the missing self in the selfie. So, I had spoken once on that topic, so all the devotees liked that topic, and many people came just because of the topic. So now, normally when we speak on the same topic, more or less the content remains the same. So some things we had just some new examples. So around 80 to 90% of the content was the same. Basically, I was talking about how in the amidst technological progress, we also need spiritual progress. So the selfie represents technological progress. The missing self represents the lack of inner satisfaction, even amidst this technological advancement. So the point was that I spoke more or less the same content, and the response I got at all four places was quite different. In one place, people were quite enthusiastic. In the first program, Salesforce, people were very enthusiastic. And when I did the program in Intel, that was like people were just... Sometimes you feel as if you're not connecting with the audience only. It's like the audience appears as if you're speaking a different language. So you try to connect, but you just don't connect. I made some jokes also, but nobody laughed. So, afterwards I asked a devotee, he says, I made this joke. He says, you look so serious. I think people thought you're not meant to laugh in your class. So, I just couldn't connect with the people. And the third program was okay. And the last program in Stanford was excellent. It was, people were laughing, clapping, and we had very vibrant question answers in after that. Now, I more or less spoke the same content all four places. I could say that the audience level was different. But everywhere there were some Indians, some non-Indians. In Stanford there were more. It was not that any place there were devotees. So at that time, it struck me that I am delivering the same speech. There is that verse in the Bhagavad Gita, in the Bhagavatam, where it says, Tadvai Dhanustar. Arjuna is saying, it's the same chariot, same bow, I'm the same Arjuna, but my potency is gone now. So actually, we definitely have to do our part in speaking well. But how much it will impact the persons, the people in the audience, that is not up to us. So we have Srila Prabhupada's Markine Bhagavad Dharma, the song which he composed on his way to America, on Jaladuta. And there he says, Krishna, please make my words understandable to me. Alankrita Koribara Kamata Tomar. He says, you, O Lord, have the capacity to make my words understandable to them. So, Tomara Ichchaya Sabha Hoye Maya Vash, Tomara Ichchaya Nashe Mayara Parash. By your will, O Lord, everybody has come under illusion. Here, will does not represent that Krishna's intention. Rather, it represents Krishna's sanction. It is within your arrangement that people have come under illusion. And it is by your arrangement that people can come out of illusion. I'll talk more about this concept of, you know, how Krishna's will is supreme and how we still have our free will a little later. But at this stage, my point is that sometimes we get this experience that we do something very well, but still the result doesn't come. How many of you have this experience that you tried something wholeheartedly, but the result didn't come? Okay, thank you. And now, sometimes I also have this experience. Sometimes it's just, I'm traveling too much, I'm a little tired, and I think again I have to give one more class. Sometimes you have 2-3 classes in a day. You're tired, somehow we go for the class, and after that, some devotee says, you know, this class was life changing. I said, life changing? Well, my life has not changed. So sometimes you don't prepare much, and still, people just feel, you can feel an impact. How many of you have that experience also, that we don't try much, but sometimes a very good result comes out? Isn't it? Yeah. So now these are all examples, both ways, that we are not the sole doers. We are definitely the doers, but we are not the sole doers. So our doership alone does not determine the result. So Krishna is saying the illusion is to think, I am the sole doer. Atmanam kevalam. So then if we are not the doer, then what else is involved in the doership? In the 13th chapter, Krishna talks about how the soul interacts with material nature. Krishna introduces the concept of the soul in the first chapter, in the second chapter of the Gita. But the interaction of the soul with material nature, he talks elaborately in the 13th chapter. So there is an interesting word, 13.21. He says, कार्य कारण कर्तृत्वे हेतुः प्रकृतिरुच्यते पुरुषः सुख दुःखानां भोक्तृत्वे हेतुरुच्यते.
Initially, if you just, it's a little difficult verse to understand. Karya, karana, kartrutve. That karya and karan, it refers to cause and effect. The chain of cause and effect happens within material nature.
Hetu prakriti ruchyate.
So material nature is the arena in which cause and effect take place. And purushah sukha dukkhanam. The happiness and distress that people experience, bhoktrutve hetu ruchyate, when they have a desire to enjoy, that's when they experience pleasure and pain. So now, that means Krishna is talking about action and reaction, or rather action and consequence, cause and effect, as within the realm of material nature. And the happiness and distress as within the realm of conscious experience. So to understand these two separate things, let's consider somebody playing a video game. And say in the video game, the person who is playing, there are some enemy soldiers coming, and you are a warrior, you have to shoot the enemy soldiers. And then, you know, you move here, move the enemy soldiers, you move, you dodge it here, and then you aim the gun and you shoot. And now, some people just get so caught, hours and hours they are playing the video game. And they say, yeah, I shot that person. Hey, come on, death missed. People are having a whole gamut of emotions over there. Come on, I have to do this, to catch this person, evade this blow, hit there. Now, actually speaking, the whole action, react, cause, effect, you know, okay. Even when they shoot, they're not doing anything. Everything is actually happening within the video screen. If the whole arrangement of the video game is not proper, you know, you aim the gun in the video game and shoot here, but the video game is not programmed properly. So you shoot here, the gun, somebody is hit over there. So the shooting, the whole setup for the play of the video game is by the programming within the video game. The player has to do some things. But no matter how well the player plays, if the arrangement is not there within the video game, he'll not be able to do anything. So similarly, we could say that material nature is like that video game. And we are the souls who are identifying with it. So this point Krishna elaborates in the next verse. Purushah prakriti sthohi bhunte prakriti jan gunan karanam guna sangosya sad asad yoni janmasu. That purushah prakriti sthohi, the soul who is transcendental, prakriti sthohi, becomes situated in material nature. Bhunte prakriti jan gunan, because of the desire to enjoy the products of material nature. That means the person can be happy in their own home, but then they see the video game screen. I want to play this video game. And that's how they get emotionally involved in it. And then, bhunte, the desire to enjoy, karanam guna sangosya, and then because of the association with the modes, sad asad yoni janmasu, one gets good and bad. So basically the result here is that a child is playing the video game and the mother is watching. The child is going through all different emotions, excitement, annoyance, suspense, thrill, dejection. The mother is watching, but the mother is not going through any of those emotions. Why? Because the mother's consciousness is not invested in that game. So it is when there is a desire to enjoy the game, that is when emotions are experienced. So the events are happening. Now this soldier is being shot, or this soldier is missing, this soldier has got wounded. All those events are happening on the video screen. But the impact is there only when the consciousness is invested. Only when there is a desire to enjoy. That's why karya karana kartrutve hetuh prakritiruchyate. Cause and effect happen within the realm of material nature. But happiness and distress are within the realm of conscious experience. Purushah sukha dukkhana bhoktrutve heturuchyate. It is when the soul invests his or her consciousness in the particular material object, that's when emotions are experienced.
So now, if we consider the video game example further with respect to doership, is the person who is playing the video game the doer? What do you think? Is the person playing the video game the doer? At one level, yes, of course, isn't it? And if they're not playing the game will not get played. But sometimes, you know, say we are working on a computer and the computer hangs. We are pressing the key, pressing the key, pressing the key, nothing is happening. So, we may say, I press the key and the computer goes here, this browser opens, this application opens. But when we are working with technology, we sometimes get the realization that, you know, I'm not the doer. Most of the time, the technology works quite well. And the technology serves an instrumental purpose. But because if it is working very effectively, we don't even notice it. When it doesn't work, oh, what's happening over here? So why is this computer not working? Sometimes we may just be surfing on the net, we'll be talking on phone. Nowadays, talking on phone has become so habitual that we may just talk with the person without even thinking, okay, I'm talking on phone right now. And we notice the phone when the phone doesn't work. So it's something similar with respect to the body. The body is a product of material nature. Krishna also uses the word yantra for the body. Yantra rudhani mayaya in 18.61. So this body works according to its own mechanisms. And normally the body works well. And because it works well, we don't even notice that there is a physical instrument involved in my functioning. So I've got a slight sprain in my hand. Normally I raise my hand and just do a lot of gestures. Right now I can't raise my hand beyond a particular angle. So now normally I don't even notice. Oh, I can't raise my hand. If I want to raise my hand, I raise my hand and make a point. But now when the hand is not working so well, that's when we notice it. So with respect to material nature, because the material nature normally works the way we want it to work, we don't even notice it. And that's how we get the notion that karta, I am the doer. Consider, for example, eating. We eat and we get energy. But there is a whole process of digestion involved in between which transforms the food into energy. And probably, unless we are doctors, the only time we remember our digestion is when it doesn't work. So what is happening? I eat food and I think, I worked hard, I earned the money to get the food, I cooked the food, and now I'm eating it. So I'm the doer. But my doership alone will not provide me energy. There is something more involved over there. So the illusion, how the process of digestion happens, I don't know that. So even if say somebody is doctor, we may know, okay, this happens this way, but we can't really make it happen. We can try to remove some impediments by which it will work out nicely, but it is a system which is already present over there. So when prakriti kriyamanani gunai karmani sarvasya, what Krishna is saying is that in the material world everything happens by the arrangements of material nature. So when we take credit for what is happening in material nature, then that is ahankar, that is illusion. Say there are three players who are playing a game of car racing. And say now in car racing also, one car might be better than another car. And just because that car is better, the person who has got that car in the video game, they will just zoom past everyone else. And as they're zooming past, and say, I'm winning. Well, you're winning, but it is not just you who are to be credited for that. No, you have got a better car than them, and that's why you're winning. So still, even with a good car also, even in the video game, one has to negotiate, one has to be careful. But still, their winning is not only because of them. Their winning is because they have got a better car than others. So similarly, all of us have got this body, which is like a car. And all of us have got cars, which are of different natures. So some people
just have a
outstanding memory. Just hear something, read something, and they remember it. And some people have a outstandingly poor memory. And actually, it is that the same person sometimes has an outstanding memory in one field and outstandingly poor memory in another field. Some people who can just do mathematical, they're mathematical geniuses. They can say multiply 10 digit, 12 digit, 13 digit numbers in one moment. Just get the answer. But when they go out, they forget where they put a car key. So for us, what happens is, we all have been given certain bodily machines, and these bodily machines, these machines are good at some things and they're not so good at some things. Now, even when they are good at some things, that we have to put in good effort so that they will give us good result. So our doership is there. In sports, sometimes some players, they may have a lot of talent, but if they don't have a good temperament, then they can't, they don't achieve much in their life. So the talent is like the machine which they have been given. Some players, just say in cricket, some players are very good batsmen, some people are very good bowlers. So some people have a very athletic body, they are very good fielders. So the talent is important. And if talent is a given, then that's like the machine, he's been given with certain abilities. Now temperament determines how we use that machine. So in corporate seminars, I say talent plus temperament leads to achievement. Talent is the ability internally. Temperament is the mood, the mindset, the inner stability. So talent and temperament together lead to achievement. So talent refers to the skill that is there within the body. But temperament refers to one's calmness, one's composure, one's clarity of thinking. So the talent is something which we all have been given, in some ways more, some ways less. Talent can also be honed. Even some people who are just born with some musical instincts, they can also practice and improve it. So talent can also be improved. But the improvement of talent is not unlimited. Some people are just born tone deaf. And a tone deaf person can never become a Mozart, no matter how much they try. They can't even make out the difference between one tune and another tune. And sometimes there are some people who are tone deaf, and they are deaf to the awareness that they are tone deaf. So then sometimes they come to a kirtan and they pick a kartal and start playing. And they are playing it all wrong, but they don't know it is wrong, so they are in bliss. And everybody around them is in agony. What are you doing? So, talent can be improved by practice, but there is a limit. It's not unlimitedly stretchable. But temperament can be substantially improved. So, now what the Bhagavad Gita is saying is that prakriti kriyamanani gunai karmani sarvasya. That means the body which we have got comes with a certain set of talents. And those talents, if we start taking credit for them, then that is illusion. If somebody is a good singer, yes, they are good singers. But it is, we don't have to deny that they are good singers, and they also don't have to deny they are good singers. But that singing ability, is it that, you know, before they were born, in the mother's womb, they massaged their throat so that it would give out good sounds? Nothing like that. They just had a sweet voice, they had a musical tendency, it just came to them. And of course they developed it, so credit is given for that. So to say that we are not the doers doesn't mean that we just become blind to seeing who can do what well. We acknowledge that. But at the same time, we also acknowledge that we alone are not the sole doers. So in sports, for example, some players may be like great batsmen in cricket, but sometimes even the best batsman goes out of form. When they go out of form, then no batsman ever wants to go out of form. They are great batsmen, and they can just sometimes when they are in touch, they are in their, as the management parlance, they say, in your flow. Then, you know, any ball comes, they just hit it for a boundary, a six, just runs flow from them. And sometimes the most straightforward ball they miss and their middle stump is knocked out. And is embarrassing. So the same person who is, who may be a super player on one day, on the next day, they might just make a major blunder. So we are the doers, but we are not the sole doers. Now when we understand this point, how does all this apply to our day-to-day living, especially with respect to planning? Now planning is a faculty of the intelligence. Now, intelligence itself has many different aspects to it. That now in modern psychology they talk about 7 different kinds of intelligences. There are some people, spatial linguist, spatial visual intelligence, interpersonal intelligence, intrapersonal intelligence. They use the acronym SLIMBL for that. Linguistic, so spatial, visual, linguistic, interpersonal, musical, what is bodily kinesthetic, intrapersonal, and SLIMBL, L is logical. So anyway, so there are different kinds of intelligences that are talked about. Now that is, what does it mean? Say somebody has got good linguistic intelligence. Means, now if somebody else is, somebody whose linguistic intelligence is not very high, they try to write a letter. They spend 1 hour, okay, how should I write this? How should I write this? How should I write this? Okay, this word is not right. This sentence is not sounding right. And somebody with a high linguistic intelligence, they just come, in 5 minutes, they rephrase it and it's done. So when the linguistic intelligence is good, at that time they can make arrangements with respect to linguistic structure very well. When the Bhagavad Gita uses the word intelligence, it uses it in a slightly different sense. Intelligence can have many different aspects. Krishna talks about intelligence in the 3 modes in the 18th chapter. I'll go into those 3 modes a little later. But basically, if you look overall, what Krishna talks about in that section is, he talks about intelligence as the capacity to discern, the capacity to discriminate between right and wrong courses of action. So, now in today's culture, the word discrimination has a very negative connotation. So, we say there should not be any gender discrimination, or there should not be any racial discrimination or caste discrimination. So, in the same of saying that there should not be any discrimination, there is discrimination against the word discrimination. So, if we use the word discrimination, we should have a good ability for discrimination. No, you should not discriminate. So the word creates some negative connotations in people's minds. So there is some amount of linguistic sensitivity required. Actually, Prabhupada uses the word cult quite frequently. At that time, cult simply meant a group of people. But in the 1970s, there were some leaders who made very insular groups. And there was one particular leader who actually called himself incarnation of God. And he had in Central America, he had his own reclusive place where he was doing all kinds of nefarious activities. But then eventually when the police came to arrest him, at that time he persuaded all his followers that now the time of deliverance has come. And if you have faith in me, then you will all be delivered. And what does have faith in me means? Commit suicide. So 1,000 people just did suicide at that time. So they just told him, and so what happened because of that, the word cult has acquired enormous negative connotation. Cult means a group of people who are very insular, who do not interact with the outer world, who are very vulnerable to be brainwashed by their leaders. So the word cult has acquired a negative connotation. That's why now more or less in our vocabulary, we never use the word cult. Srila Prabhupada used it. That word is just not appropriate in today's world. Similarly, the word preacher has also acquired quite a negative connotation. Now, preacher, oh, you mean you will sit on a high pedestal and you will say that, oh, you're going to preach to me. So nowadays, most of us try to use the word outreach rather than preaching. So sometimes words just trigger some associations in people's minds. In philosophy of language, there is the whole discussion, and this is also talked about in Mimamsa by Anjeev Goswami, talks about in Sandarbhas, that where is the meaning of word stored? Is it stored in the dictionary, or is it stored in people's minds? That means, in a dictionary, this word means this. Yes, the words are stored, meaning are stored in dictionaries, or we can say the words meaning are stored in the letters itself. But words have multiple connotations. So, for example, there are some words in English. The word "run" has run amok. What does that mean? The word "run" has got 645 meanings. So now we instinctively think, okay, hey, what does this word mean? What does this word mean? But are you running for the elections? It doesn't mean you're physically running. So some people, there is a disease. There's a disease in which people take every mental disease, not a serious disease, in which people take everything literally. So, you know, he ran away to America. Oh, he must have run for a long time. So words have different meanings. That's why the meanings of words are not stored just in the letters themselves. They're also stored in the context. Yeah? Take this pill.
And they are like, where do I take this pill?
Okay, yeah, that's true. Thank you. Yeah.
The word religion is a word that fits your category.
Exactly. The word religion has got a very strong negative connotation nowadays. Let's say there's a large group of people who identify themselves as SBNR. It's spiritual, but not religious. So they say that religious means close-minded, religious means dogmatic, religious means imposing your views on others, causing conflicts. I want to be spiritual. So we have to be sensitive to the nuances of words also. So words have their meanings. The words have certain meanings in the lexicon, but along with that, in people's minds, words have certain connotations. And we have to be aware of that. So this is the detour. But I took this detail because we're talking about the word discrimination. Intelligence, the way the Bhagavad Gita talks about it, is in terms of discerning. I use the word discernment nowadays instead of discrimination. Capacity to discern. This is right, this is wrong. Now, we may say that, okay, somebody has high linguistic intelligence, then also they have good discerning capacity. This sentence works. This sentence doesn't work. If somebody has high musical intelligence, okay, now this tune is very good. This is not sounding nice. So in a sense, in all kinds of intelligence are associated with the capacity to discern what is right from what is wrong. But in these seven kinds of intelligences, there is no room, which modern psychologists talk about, there is no mention of what you could say is ethical intelligence. Ethical intelligence means, now, what action is good and what action is bad? What action will have desirable consequences and what action will have undesirable consequences? So when the Bhagavad Gita, generally in spiritual circles, when we use the word intelligence, it is more in terms of discerning the consequences of actions. So will this action help me to grow spiritually? Or will this action drag me away from my spiritual consciousness? So that capacity to discern is the primary function of intelligence. And to the extent a person has this intelligence, to that extent, they can actually use other intelligences properly. Sometimes a person may have very good, say, medical skills. They may be very good doctors. But if they don't, we could say the medical intelligence. Medical intelligence could have, if they're surgeons, they have their body kinesthetic ability, but they just know where to cut, how to cut. But if they don't have ethical intelligence, then they will go to a doctor and they'll treat patients, and instead of treating the patients, they will just prolong the treatment. Just aggravate this. Sometimes even doctors go to the extent of, you know, stealing organs while healing people. So what is happening here? They have medical intelligence, but they don't have the ethical intelligence. So without the ethical intelligence, whatever ability we have, we can't use it to do good to others or even good to ourselves in the long run.
and say that a doctor heals you with his pills and then kills you with his bills. Doctor heals our ills with his pills and then kills us with his bills. So sometimes the doctors are just too, no offense against doctors here, just giving a doctor an example. It could be any profession. But the point is that we have, the Bhagavad Gita talks about intelligence primarily in terms of choosing actions that help us to grow spiritually. It talks about the capacity to discern properly. And with respect to planning and with respect to bhakti, the attitude with which we do planning, that will determine whether our planning is done in a mood of submission, in a mood of service to Krishna, or we do it in a mood of domination. Think, I am the doer, just see how great I am. And that's how the planning the capacity to plan, the capacity to organize, that can work to help us grow in our devotion, because we may be able to organize more and do more service effectively. And Srila Prabhupada also said in one of his last instructions that Krishna consciousness movement will spread by organization and intelligence. So both organization and intelligence refer to planning. So certainly planning is required in bhakti. But depending on the mode we are in, we will plan in different ways. And accordingly, our consciousness will be differently affected, both when we make the plan and based on whether the plan works out or it doesn't work out. So I'll talk about the three modes and intelligence and planning in three modes after a little break. I'll summarize now and we can have a few questions. So I spoke about, does God laugh at our plans? And that the mood of this quip is that if we think that we are the doers and we will do everything, it's like a child thinking I'll build a big house because the child was able to build a sand castle. So that is laughable, not in the sense that the parents are sadistic, but the child doesn't know what all is involved in doing things. So similarly, to understand what all is involved in doing things, we discuss the concept of doership. The Bhagavad Gita first says but material nature is doing everything, to think that we are the doer is ego. But later it says, Arjuna, do as you desire. And Krishna says, Arjuna says, I will do as you desire. So the illusion is not doership, but illusion is soul doership. That's 18.16. And then I give the example of a video game which a child is playing. Now, depending on how good the video game is, the child will be able to do this and do that, and shoot this person, move out of the way of this bullet, chase that car, whatever. Now the mechanism for it all is set in the video game. The child requires some expertise, but the child's effort and expertise is not of much use if the mechanism would not be there in the video game. So similarly, we all have been given a body which has its own mechanisms, which has its own abilities and inabilities. And if we start taking credit for what actually is done by the body, then we are an illusion. So when we speak, when we sing, even when we eat food, there's a lot more than our action going in to produce the result. So digestion happens. Normally, because if the technology works very well, I'm talking on phone, but I don't even notice I'm talking on phone. But when it doesn't work, hey, are you hearing me? Can you hear my voice? We start asking. That's when we notice we are talking on phone. So similarly, when our body doesn't work, that's when we notice, okay, I'm not the sole doer. So the ability that is there in the body, that is something which different people have differently. That is the talent which people have. And our capacity to use that bodily resource properly, that is the temperament. Talent can also be honed by practice, but the improvement is not unlimited. However, temperament can be improved much more. And improving our temperament means understanding actually how things are happening. So, with respect to talent, if we talk about intelligences, the seven type of intelligence that psychologists talk about, they are referring to certain innate abilities that people have. When the Bhagavad Gita uses the word intelligence, it uses it primarily in the capacity of ethical intelligence, to discern
the consequences of actions in terms of their results with respect to our spiritual growth. So the word discrimination is traditionally used to refer to this capacity of moral discernment. But discrimination has negative connotation, just like the words cult or religion also have negative connotations to our teaching. They're negative connotations. So the meanings of words are not just stored in the dictionary or in the arrangement of the letters. It is also stored in the context, in the connotations that they trigger in people's minds. And when we understand that we are the doers, but we are not the sole doers, then we use our intelligence in a mood of submission, not in a mood of domination. So definitely when we are to serve Krishna, planning is important. Prabhupada wanted us to be organized and intelligent, which means to plan. But the modes will shape the attitude with which we plan, and accordingly that will affect whether our planning increases our devotional attitude or it increases our dominating attitude. So are there any questions or comments at this stage? Yes, you have a question?
Okay.
Yeah, go back. I'll repeat the question also.
So we are not the sole doer. So like there are say 5 doers. If we just plot on a pie chart, so our percentage is so much in the whole activity. So should we think like that and slack, or still put our best?
Okay, if there are different doers, then should we think that, okay, my percentage is only this much, how much I can do? And will that make us slack thinking like that?
No, like if our contribution is only a part, then sometimes can we just slack, there are other factors taking care, but you can slack a little bit in our...
Okay, so thinking that there are other factors involved in getting the results, should we sometimes become slack, or will thinking that there are other factors involved make us slack in our doing of activities? Yeah. So it depends on the overall context. That means that there are certain things which we are good at. See, the Bhagavad Gita talks about the concept of kshetra. Kshetra, Prakriti is overall material nature. Kshetra is that area within material nature on which a soul has been given control. This whole world is very big, but this body is the area where I have been given control. Even in this body also, my control is not entire. There is some control, but I have some control over it. I don't have control over your body. So this body is my kshetra. Now the kshetra, the sphere of control, it is not just with respect to the body. Some people have great speaking ability. Then that speaking ability expands their kshetra. So some people have great organizing skills. Then they have that organizing, you do this, I do this, we'll take care of this, that's how we'll do it. That expands their kshetra. So we all have been given certain abilities which determine our kshetra, our area of influence or area of control. So, in certain fields, we understand that I have to make sure that I do my part very well. Say, if I am writing an article to submit to a magazine, then I have to make sure that the thoughts are flowing nicely, the grammar is good, the punctuation is good, the points are interestingly made. And then after that, the editors will decide whether it's going to be published or not. So that is beyond me. But for me, I have to do my part well. So in some areas, we can do things so well that more or less the results will naturally come. But in some areas, we put in a lot of efforts and still the results may not come. Like I said, a tone-deaf person, it's very difficult for them to become a great musician. So then, we have to use our overall intelligence to understand whether this particular area I need to keep working more or I have done enough. If it is going to work, it's okay. Otherwise, let me do something else in my life. So that requires, if I don't put in my effort, even a person who is a good writer, good at language, but if they don't put in the proper efforts, then they may not get the result. So we always need to put in our efforts. That's why karmanye padhikaraste mate sangostva karmani. 2.47 A and D. If you consider the four lines of a verse to be A, B, C, D. So the first line is A. It says you have a right to do your work. Not just a right, actually it's a responsibility. Mate sangostva karmani. That you don't be attached to not doing the work. So we do our best, and beyond that we leave the rest to Krishna. So see if it works out. Now, how do we know what is our best? We have to have a sense of proportion. That means we have many responsibilities, many roles in our life. And, okay, how much time can I give to this role? Say, A, if I have to write a letter for something. If I spend 3 days writing a letter. Well, if it's that important, it's okay. But then I may have to decide. This is important, but I can't spend any more time than this. So Srila Prabhupada writes in the 10th chapter purport that intelligence means to see things in their proper perspective. That to see things in their proper perspective. You know, what is more important, what is less important, how much importance needs to be given to what. So in a particular endeavor, how much we persevere will depend on how important it is. So for example, Srila Prabhupada himself, he adjusted many things. Adjusted means, first he tried to say work, write, publish Back to Godhead, but he did not get much response. Then he tried to open the League of Devotees, and that didn't work out. He tried to work with his god brothers. Then he went to Vrindavan and he wrote the Bhagavatam. Then he went to America. So his purpose was fixed. His process, or you could say his path, the method that he used to fulfill that purpose was flexible. Okay, back to God didn't work, let me try to start organizing. That doesn't work, let me do that. So now how much time, how much effort to put for what? That is something which we have to decide according to our intelligence. So we try to do our best, and if things work out, good. If they don't work out, then you may think, maybe that should I use our intelligence? Should I persevere in this field or should I try something else? A devotee doesn't give up the intention to serve Krishna ever. But how to go about doing that, we may have to be flexible about that. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Yes, please. Hare
Krishna. Hello. Hare Krishna, we say Lord Krishna is the cause of all causes. Is it that all planning, what we are doing now, is pre-planned by Krishna?
Okay. If Krishna is the cause of all causes, then is all the planning that we are doing also planned by Krishna? See, Krishna is the cause of all causes, not the cause of all effects. What do you mean, not the cause of all effects? Simple example. Say, if different vegetation grows on the ground, some place crops grow, some place fruits grow, some place weeds grow, the rain is the cause of the growth of all vegetation, ultimately. So the rain is the cause of all causes, is with respect to the vegetation's growth. But the rain is not the cause of all effects. The rain is not responsible for which vegetation grows where. So the Bhagavad Gita gives the example, yatha akasha sito nityam vayu sarvatra gomahan tatha sarvani bhutani matsthani tyopadharaya. That just as the wind flows within the sky, similarly all living beings exist within my will. It's 9.6 in the Gita. If we envision the sky to be like an upside down ball, then that ball determines the area of movement of the air. It doesn't determine the movement itself. The movement, the air can move left, right, up, down. But how much it can move is determined by the sky, by the covered ball, if you could say. Similarly, Krishna has given us free will. And with that free will, we are meant to choose. By our past karma, as I said, we have been given some kshetra, some area of influence. And within that area of influence, we can choose the way we want. And sometimes we may choose right, sometimes we may choose wrong. And our choice is not determined by Krishna. The most graphic example, which I was going to speak later, but I'll mention it now since the question came up, of how our plan and Krishna's plan can work exactly at opposite, is the example of Krishna going as Shantidut to meet the Kauravas. Krishna was petitioning for peace and Duryodhana said no. Duryodhana rejected it. So can a jiva reject the will of the Lord? Yeah, the jiva has been given free will. We will have to get the consequences of what we do. But we can do it. Duryodhana was so Duryodhana by his past karma had been given some influence. And with that influence, he had the dominion over the kingdom. And he could do what he wanted during that time. Now, when say people do bad things, it is not that God wants them to do those bad things. It is not that their bad actions are planned by God. Otherwise, it would be like God is responsible for all the suffering. Because he only makes people drink alcohol. He is responsible for my addiction. No, he is not responsible for addiction. It is you. It is the addict who is responsible for the addiction. So, Krishna, everything that happens, when you say upadrashta, sometimes you say not a blade of grass moves without God's will. Actually, that is a way of talking about God's supreme controllership. A more precise way of saying it would be, not a blade of grass moves without God's sanction. Because many times people do certain things which it's not that God wants them to do it. Krishna has told in scripture, do this and don't do this. And many times people defy scripture, knowingly or unknowingly. It's not that Krishna wants them to do that, but they have been given free will and then they do that. But whatever anyone does, it is within the scope of Krishna's plan. That means even if, say, in a school, the school's purpose is that students study, give their exams, pass the exam and go to a higher standard. But if a student fails, the school has a plan for that also. Okay, you can give this exam again, you can study like this. So, our wrong choices are also within Krishna's plan. But our wrong choices are not Krishna's plan. The student failing is within the school's plan. But the school doesn't plan that the student should fail. So, in that sense, nothing happens outside Krishna's jurisdiction. But that doesn't mean everything that happens is Krishna's intention. Does it answer your question? Yes.
You said when Krishna was wanting
for the microphone.
When Krishna was wanting peace, and Arjuna said no, he wanted to fight, right? And Arjuna was saying that when Arjuna was telling Krishna, I don't want to kill, they're all my relatives, and Krishna said, well, I've already killed them, and look at them, they're all going into my mouth. So technically, didn't Krishna already kill them? So, like,
okay. So in the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna says that I don't want to kill my relatives, but then Krishna says that they're already killed by my plan. So then, wasn't it destined to happen? Destiny is firstly very complex to understand, but suffice it to say that. Actually, what is destined doesn't determine, okay, let me put it this way, the word destined, tomorrow, Sunday, if we say I'm going to speak on destiny. But here, so the word destiny has two distinct meanings. One is what happens to us. Oh, it was destined to happen. But say somebody is a very talented person, talented, say, sports player, and then that person becomes a champion sportsman. You see, he fulfilled his destiny. She fulfilled her destiny. So here, destiny, we can use it in two senses. What happens to us and what we are meant to do. So there are two different senses of the word destiny. Now, what happens to us, that may be destined. But what we are meant to do, we have to put in efforts to do it. Yes, we could say that mayai vaite nihata purvameva. By my arrangement, the Kauravas are killed already. But does that mean that Arjuna has no free will? Does that mean necessarily that the Kauravas had no free will? Does that mean that it's Krishna's plan that Dushyasan disrobed Draupadi? And therefore, as a consequence, he would have to be killed? No. When we say something is destined, that simply means that certain actions have certain consequences. So Krishna also says to the Pandavas, to Draupadi especially, the Kauravas by their actions are doomed now. By dishonoring you, they have invited death. But we shouldn't think of destiny as entirely inflexible. See, destiny means, broadly speaking, there is a certain quantity of happiness and a certain quantity of distress that we are going to get. Now, specifically, how we get that happiness and how we get that distress, that will vary. It's not that everything is destined. On one level, we sometimes say that the number of breaths a person is going to take is destined. But then another level, the same tradition, there is a whole branch of knowledge called Ayurveda. And Ayu means lifespan. So it is a knowledge that lengthens one's lifespan. So now if our lifespan is destined, how can our lifespan be lengthened? So the point is that the destiny, that our lifespan is shaped not just by what we have done in the past. It is also shaped by how we do act in the present. See, at an extreme level, we know if somebody commits suicide, that means that they have ended their life prematurely. But if somebody drives drunk and then they die in an accident, now was that destined? That would mean that drinking was destined. And that means where is their free will? So at one time in Prabhupada Nectar, there is an incident which is described by Satsuru Maharaj. There are some devotees going on Guru's mission. They drove very fast. And they met with an accident. And some of them perished in the accident. So Prabhupada was asked, was it their destiny? Prabhupada said, no, it was their responsibility. They should have driven more carefully. In the Mahabharata, there is a very striking contrast. Before the war happens, at that time, Vidura, Vyasa, and many other sages are trying to persuade Dhritarashtra. Don't let this war proceed. Stop your wicked son. So at that time Dhritarashtra says that if this war is destined, then who am I, a tiny mortal, to stop the working of almighty destiny? And then Vidura replies, the memorable line, he says, destiny determines the consequences of our actions, not our actions themselves. Destiny determines the consequences of our actions, not our actions themselves. If a student has got an exam and student doesn't study for the exam, mother says, please study. She says, no, whatever I am destined, I'll get that. No, destiny doesn't determine. After you study, what marks you will get, that is determined by destiny. But whether you study or not, that is not determined by destiny. That is for you to do. So, now, here, it's very strongly stressed. Vidura speaks this, but again, when Vyasadev comes, again, he asks Vyasadev that, oh, is this war destined? Vyasa remains silent for a long time. And then he says that actually destiny is very difficult to discern, O king. What we can discern is what is our duty. And deliberate and do what is your duty, O king. Now interestingly, after the Kurukshetra war gets over and Dhritarashtra is grief-struck, all his 100 sons have been killed, and he is lamenting. At that time Vyasadeva comes and says that, O king, do not lament. This war was destined. And now do your duty. Now don't beat yourself up for having caused the death of your sons. Just move forward in your life. So now, was the war destined or was it not destined? Well, when Krishna went to Shantidut, if Duryodhana had listened, they could have avoided the war, isn't it? So what it means is that there is philosophy and there is a purpose of philosophy. So the philosophy is meant to enhance our spirituality. Like we have Hiranyakashipu, who is in the 7th canto, speaking that the soul is indestructible. And therefore, I will perform austerity lifetime after lifetime till I become strong enough to kill Vishnu. So, he is using the philosophy, but for what purpose? To defeat the purpose of the philosophy. Vedaishcha sarvairahameva vedyam. So, we have to always see that what is the purpose of the philosophy is to enhance people's consciousness. So, initially, by saying that everything is destined, Dhritarashtra was abdicating his responsibility. So they told, no, think of what is your duty and do your duty. But later, when now the thing is out of his hands, so it's already happened, then now in order to focus on your duty, think that, okay, it was destined. So rather than thinking of destiny as something rigid, if I have the capacity to make healthy choices, that may bring about some changes. But if already the action has happened, then you say that, okay, it's happened, now move forward in life. So destiny ultimately is like Krishna's plan. So actually all the points I wanted to speak in the last session, now they are all coming out here. So I don't know what to speak later. But say example I'd like to give, that say we are going to a particular place driving to a particular place, we are using Google Maps. So then when you are using Google Maps, say Google says turn left, but then I turn right. Then what happens? I turn right. It's that we will go further away, but it's not that, what does Google reroutes? It doesn't say Google gets angry and get lost. So Google will reroute. Say now take a right from here. Again, if we take a wrong turn, again Google will reroute. So no matter how many wrong turns we take, there will be a reroute back. Now of course every wrong turn will have its consequence. It will take that much longer for us to get to the destination. But no matter how many wrong turns we have taken, there is always a path back from there. So when before the Kurukshetra war, for Dhritarashtra, the right choice was stop his son Dhritarashtra. So don't say that it is destined. But now, when he has taken the wrong turn and he has gone a long, long direction, suppose I was supposed to come to this program and I take a wrong turn and go somewhere else. And then I start beating myself. Why did I take a wrong turn? Why did I take a wrong turn? Why did I take a wrong turn? Now take a right turn and come back. Isn't it? So similarly, when Vyasadeva is telling Dhritarashtra that the war was destined, okay, there was a wrong turn that was taken, but see that it was destined and now move forward, now take the right turn. So sometimes if you just look, the philosophy is actually an integrated philosophy. If we take the philosophy in isolation, it can lead to a lot of misunderstandings. So, with respect to destiny, there is daiva and there is dharma. Dharma is duty. So duty, the whole purpose is to be duty-centered, not destiny-centered. When Ram is exiled to the forest, at that time, he says that it is, I see this as the will of destiny. Otherwise, Kaikeyi, who loved me so much, how did she turn against me like this overnight? So Lakshman is very angry with this. So Lakshman says, you should rebel against it. He says, no. He says, when Kaikeyi's love was like the Ganga flowing so incessantly towards me. Lakshman is still angry. He says, that's what I can't understand. How did the Ganga dry up overnight? So then Ram says, that's when I understood that this is the will of destiny. And Lakshman says, it's only cowards who call injustice as destiny. He says, heroes fight against injustice. And Ram says that I am not concerned about destiny primarily. I am concerned about my duty. It was as a duty to my father that I was ready to accept the kingdom. As a duty to my father, now I am going to the forest. Because that's what he told me to do. Now, but that same Ram, when Sita was abducted, he did not think, oh, that is the will of destiny, so I'll accept it. Why not? Because at that time, his duty was, he has to protect his wife. So, the whole focus is to be duty-centered, not destiny-centered. And if talking about destiny can help inspire us to do our duty better, then we talk about destiny. If talking about destiny is being used to not do our duty properly, then we don't talk about destiny. Or we don't consider destiny at that time. The focus is on duty. Vasudev tells Kamsa that you are trying to kill your own wife, kill your own sister. But if it's death is destined, it will come. What will you get by doing this terrible sinful activity of killing your own sister? Now Vasudev doesn't turn that around and think, if Devaki is destined to die, what am I doing trying to persuade Kamsa? Why? Because for him it is duty that is important. And when its duty is concerned, he doesn't think too much about destiny. Let me do my best. But when somebody is deviating from duty, then he reminds them. Destiny is that you don't do something sinful like this. Okay? Thank you. Yes, so,
Can you explain this in Hindi a little bit, destiny and destiny? Just this question.
Okay. Can we talk after the class, if you don't mind? Maybe in the break or something, we'll talk at that. I'll talk, yes. Yes, Mother.
This is important.
I can repeat the question.
Yeah. I just had a question. You didn't talk about temperament.
Yeah.
I
want to talk about intelligence in three modes, and I talk about it, that time it will come.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yes. Yes. You had a question, Mother?
Hare Krishna. You said that duty, we should be duty bound and not destiny centered.
Yeah.
Now, when it comes to raising children, it's our duty as a parent to guide our children. But when do we stop that? And like, when do we? When do we leave it to destiny? That I'm doing my best, but it's really not working. So that it's very difficult to put that boundary. When do you stop?
So in parenting, it is our duty to guide our children, but beyond a particular age, we just have to leave it to destiny. So how do we decide when to do that? Yeah.
I'm not sure we have to leave it to destiny if the duty shifts.
Yeah, I listen.
Whose duty it becomes shifts. Because at some point, a child grows to the point where the duty starts to shift into his hands.
Yes, that's true. Yes. Thank you. Yes. I agree. That's the Chanakya Pandit's verse that Panchavarshana Lalayet, Dashavarshani Tadayet, Prapte to Shodashe Varshe, Putram Mitravadacharet. That. And this for the first 5 years, pamper the child. Then after that, discipline the child. And then treat the child like an equal, like a friend. So what Mataji is saying is that there will be different phases when the way we perform our duty is different. Initially, for a very small child, we are more like an instructor. Do this, don't do this. Then we may become more like a guide. And then we may just have to become a friend. That means, friend means sometimes that other person consults, sometimes they will not consult. So instructor and guide is also different. Instructor means the person has to do it. But the guide, sometimes they may accept, sometimes they may not accept the guidance. But friendship means it's entirely on their onus. So basically, in every relationship, the relationship itself is not static. The kshetra, I talked about the sphere of influence which we have, that keeps changing. So our sphere of influence, when they are very small, it is practically their sphere of influence is entirely inside our sphere of influence. A child doesn't want, child wants to go out, parents say, no, you can't go out. So they can't at that time. But as the children grow up, they have their own sphere of influence. And after some time, it may become that their sphere of influence is half inside our sphere, half outside our sphere. Now we may monitor what they do at home, but we can't monitor what they're doing in college, what they're doing elsewhere. And eventually, when they have their own family, when they have their own life, at that time, there may be very little sphere of influence. Intersection. There is some definitely, because the relationship is there. But the non-overlapping part will be much, much more. Now, how much overlap will be there when? That will vary depending not just on time of the child's life, but also based on the culture. So for example, in traditional cultures, the children, even when they grow up, they defer to their parents. Not in traditional cultures, maybe we say Eastern cultures. In Western cultures, for various reasons, for various historical, social reasons, actually, that deference is not there so much. In fact, right from teenage itself, sometimes kids start taking their own jobs and they pay for their college education. So now, when we have children of people who have come from the East but now they are settled in the West, there is this phenomenon called ABCD. In America, they call it American born confused Deshis. So, you know, they themselves have an identity crisis. You know, who am I actually? Am I Indian or am I American? They try to become American, but they realize, I can't be an American actually. They try to be an Indian, but they're culturally so much, they're culturally born in a particular culture. So sometimes we just have to recognize at a particular point, if trying to guide them is alienating them further, then it's best to shift roles. There's an American author who said, I think it's Mark Twain, he said that when I was 15, my father was a fool. Now I'm 25 and I'm amazed how much the old guy has learned in the last 10 years. So sometimes in the phase of adolescence, there's a rebellion. And in that rebellion, it may be that they can't see the wisdom of what their elders are telling them. But especially when they grow older, when they have their children, then they start seeing the wisdom. So sometimes some of us may just have to learn by experience. And if we with our intelligence feel that what they're doing is wrong, then we try to tell that to them. But sometimes if telling that is alienating them further, then sometimes we just have to give them their freedom. There are certain wrong actions which they may do, and they will get the consequences of those actions. But maybe that is what they need to go through to learn. And at least if we will give them that leeway, then they will have some relationship with us. But if we try to keep dominating, no, you should not do this, you should not do this, then eventually what happens is we start avoiding. This one devotee, I was talking with him, he's a teenager, and he was talking with him and he got a phone call. So I look at his phone, he's written jail. I said, what is this jail? He said, that's my home. So the number of his home he had put as jail over there. So that's sad. If you feel like that, sometimes kids just grow up and then just avoid their parents because they felt so dominated earlier that they just don't want to have any connection. So it's better that ultimately even Krishna gives us freedom, isn't it? So at one level there is a responsibility of the parents toward the children, but at another level there is the individual free will also. And if Krishna can't control the soul's free will, who are we as parents to control our children's free will? We can give them guidance, but beyond that, it's between them, it's up to them to choose. And if we have given them spiritual impressions in the childhood, then those will prompt them to make wiser choices in the long run. But in between, they may have to go through some learning through experience. So if somebody says that, if we try to be very insistent, if we try to make that love, make our love for our children conditional to their doing particular actions, you have to do this, you have to marry this person, you have to take this job, you have to choose this career, then that will alienate them. And if you have to practice spiritual life, then if suppose they say, no, I'm not going to practice, then suppose the parent says, I'm right, and one day you will realize you're so arrogant right now, one day you will come crawling back on your knees to me. Now in future, even if they realize they are wrong, still they will not come back, because then it becomes an issue of the ego for them. So it's okay, that's what we can make our opinion or our pleasure or displeasure felt to them, make it clear. But beyond that, we didn't hold that as the defining filter through which we look at the whole relationship. Whatever they do, they're still our children, and we offer them our love. Of course, how we express that love will vary depending on what they are doing. But sometimes people have to learn through their experiences. And we also learn through our experience. Something we learn through intelligence, something we learn through experience. So we have to also have that sense of detachment. Mate sangostva karmani. Do not be attached to the fruits of your work. Sometimes for parents, the child becomes a... we say there is a responsibility, and responsibility is there, but there's also a sense of possessiveness over there. The child becomes an extension of the ego of the parent. I am such a good person, my child should be like this. A child is not becoming like this, that means I feel insecure. So we have to actually, our primary identity has to come from our relationship with Krishna. I am first and foremost a servant of Krishna. As a servant of Krishna, I am the father of so-and-so, I am the mother of so-and-so, I am the husband of so-and-so, I am the wife of so-and-so. If any relationship other than our relationship with Krishna becomes our defining relationship, then the problems in that relationship will be devastating for us. Any problem in any close relationship will be distressing, no doubt. But distressing is one thing, devastating or shattering is another thing. If that relationship is our defining identity, if I define myself as a parent first and foremost, if my child goes off on the wrong track, then I feel my life is a waste. And if I feel that way, then when I am acting with that child, I am not acting based on what they are doing. I am acting based on the insecurity that they are creating within me. And then we overreact quite often. So sometimes if we see that they are We tried our tried as much as we could. We gave them some good advice, but if they're just not listening, and the more we try to give them good advice, the more they get alienated, then maybe that's a time when we have to do hands off. And then they will have to learn to experience. Krishna is there in their hearts. Krishna will guide them. So we have to at some times also learn detachment. So responsibility does not mean possessiveness. And detachment doesn't mean apathy. Possessiveness means, you know, you have to do what I tell you to do. You cannot do anything without my sanction or my information or my permission. That's possessiveness. Responsibility means I do my part in the relationship. But it's they are souls with their free will. Now, means it's not that I don't care what you do. That is apathy. That would be irresponsibility, apathy. But detachment means that you know, I'm not going to be emotionally fixated in what you are doing. Now, I'll tell you what I feel is the best. But if you do something else, then it's your life. We have to develop that detachment. And in every relationship, there are times when we are in control, and there are times when we have to cede control to the other person. So as the children grow older, and that is the time when we have to cede control. And although we cede control, see, if we were thinking that, you know, we are their shapers, we are their molders, then ceding control becomes very difficult. But if we think that I am a servant of Krishna, acting as a shaper of their character, and Krishna is the ultimate shaper. So till this point in their life, I took care of them. Now it is Krishna will act through someone else. Sometimes the same thing which we tell to our children, they may not accept, but if they meet some other kids of their own youth group, okay, their age, their own generation, they learn the same thing from them, they may accept, okay, you also doing it, I can do it. So, you know, when I was initially introduced to bhakti, I asked Jayadvaita Maharaj, how should I preach to my parents? So Maharaj said, by letting anyone except you preach to them. So there, especially in traditional culture, there's a parent-child dynamic, and they can't see you as a teacher. So we have to see even our relationships like a relay race. You know, in a relay race, you know, you carry that torch up to a particular distance. And then after you cover the distance, you say, no, I want to take it till the end. No, your role is over now. Let somebody else carry the relay torch. So like that, parenting is also like that. We carry the torch up to a particular point. And then after that, we see if we can connect them with some other guides, some other friends, some other people. We try to give them good association, and ultimately Krishna is there in their hearts. So if we are thinking that I am the shaper, if they're going on the wrong track is causing us distress, that's understandable. But if it's causing us too much agitation, if it's causing us a sense of failure and lack of self-worth and an identity crisis, then we have to think that maybe I'm investing too much in the relationship. I have to take a step back. I'm not the controller. I'm not God. By God's arrangement, I was an instrument for guiding this person till this point. But now, it is the way I am getting signals is, now Krishna doesn't want me here. This person doesn't want me, and that is a signal from Krishna that maybe I have to take a step back. So there's no point in trying to give advice where it is being consistently rejected. There's no point in that. It's simply that advice is not only not going to be accepted, but that advice is going to alienate others. So that's the time to take back and let Krishna guide them from within their hearts. Okay.
Is there anything in the scriptures which speaks about responsibility of parents and like how long you can? Is there any consequences of not, you know, directing your children properly?
Okay, are there any consequences of not directing your children properly?
Or at least not see the results of you are directing, but you are not.
We have to understand that scripture gives specific pastimes. But beyond that, there are principles. Generally, in any relationship, getting the idea of karma is, it will unnecessarily complicate the relationship. Whether it is, you know, oh, if you are going to do this, I'll get the karma for that. You know, if you start thinking like that, and now does the spiritual master have a guarantee that after taking initiation, the disciple is not going to do any bad karma? If the spiritual master starts getting very worried about that, they will not initiate anyone only. So, we have to say that ultimately, this whole point of karma, it is not meant to, Krishna is not like a judgmental boss who is waiting to catch us doing wrong. Hey, I caught you! Now you have to get this punishment. Krishna is not like that. You know? See, that person did that wrong, that's why you want to get this karma now. It's not like that. The whole point of karma is to inspire us to do our dharma. But beyond that, say, if a disciple comes to a spiritual master and says, you know, I'm in a phase of life where I can't chant 16 rounds. Now, the spiritual master just started, how dare you don't chant 16 rounds? Oh, this. Now, obviously, the spiritual master, you do to initiation, wow, how can you not do it? But if that person is not doing that, then what can you do? What can you do ultimately? And I was talking with one senior sannyasi, a spiritual master, saying that when a disciple comes like that, you know, what can you do at that time? Ultimately, they are souls with their free will. And at least, they could just have stopped chanting and not even told. At least they have that much, they think they have that much relationship that they are coming and telling. Then at least maintain that relationship. Okay. Then you do what you can. And maybe in future you will be able to chant. Now that's definitely not recommended. And what I'm saying should not take it as sanction in any way for that. But the point is that even in a relationship as exalted spiritually, as the spiritual master and disciple, the spiritual master is far more advanced than what most of us parents are. But even in that case also, the disciple may do something wrong. Now, is it that the spiritual master is going to get every single bad karma of the disciple? Ultimately, Krishna is in charge. And Krishna sees the mood. The spiritual master's mood was that, you know, I want fame, I want glory. And that's why anybody and everyone they initiate. Then, that will have its consequences. But if the spiritual master was doing it in the mood of compassion, mood of service, and then later on, if somebody does something wrong, it's okay. It's not that Krishna is going to hold us responsible for that. So I was talking about this. So this particular spiritual master was telling me that very exalted Vaishnava. I said that when a disciple comes and tells me something like this, he says, I just consciously avoid thinking also about karma. I think about, you know, what will encourage this person. Because if I start thinking about karma, if you do this, you know, I'll get the karma. And I don't want to get the karma. And then my focus becomes not how I can best serve him or her. My focus becomes how I can protect myself. Then where is the service attitude gone? So in our relationships, we are meant to be servants. And the spiritual master is also a servant of the disciple. The parents are also servants of the children. So at this stage, what is it that will help them at that level? We have to see that and act accordingly. So sometimes just encouraging them to not say they have taken one wrong turn and they're determined to stay on that wrong turn only. At least don't take another wrong turn which will take them further away. Stay over there. They could have been coming to Krishna, but they're staying at this distance from Krishna. At least let them stay at that distance. Let them not go further away from Krishna. And later on they'll come towards Krishna. So I think this karma is something which... See, karma is ultimately logical. It is not mystical. It is not that, you know, you're mystical. You know, oh, that person did that, that's why you're going to get this karma. It's not like that. In relationships, there is certainly some amount of accountability. Each other's actions have... if you're in a close relationship, the other person's actions will have consequences for us. But karma is not... certainly, it's not mystical, it's not judgmental. Like in normal society also, say if a child is very small and at that time the child does something wrong, the parents are held responsible. But if, say, somebody who is 30, 40, they do something wrong, is the law going to hold the parents responsible for that? No. If the child has incurred a lot of debt, well, sometimes the parents may, out of their willingness, pay that debt. But sometimes the child may just become bankrupt and may have to go to a debtor's prison or whatever. It varies. So it is not that, see, the government itself is, government also has that much sense of objectivity and, you could say, perspective. That for an adult, the parents can't be held responsible. So it is not that Krishna, who is supremely wise, is going to hold us responsible for the wrongdoings of our children, if they do anything wrong. It is, of course, talked about that it is a primary responsibility of the children, parents, to make their children into devotees. That is definitely talked about in scripture. There is the famous verse that, Guru na sasyat. One should not become a guru, one should not become a father, unless one can deliver. But the mood of that is that means whenever you enter into that relationship, enter it with that mood of responsibility. That does not mean that if you are not able to deliver your disciple, then as a guru you are a failure. So when you enter into the relationship, enter into that particular role, recognize that it's a responsible role. In our tradition, we consider Advaita Acharya to be an incarnation of the Lord. But Advaita Acharya's son became a Mayavadi. Now, Advaita Acharya is Mahavishnu. His son became a Mayavadi. There are, at the very origin of Gaudiya Vaishnavism itself, there are events which they were like catastrophic. We caught earthquakes within Gaudiya Vaishnavism at that time. But of course, his Mayavad was very different. He started thinking because Advaita Acharya called Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And following Advaita Acharya's call, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came. Therefore, he considered Advaita Acharya to be greater than Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. It is not Mayavad saying that we are all Brahman. It was because Advaita Acharya is actually God and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is subordinate to him. So it is quite a complex thing. But the point is that we are not held responsible. And rather than thinking of either I'll get karma for this or I'll get karma for that, can focus on how can I do my dharma best in this situation? How can I best ensure that this person doesn't go off too much on the wrong track? If they don't come on the right track, at least make sure that they don't go too much on the wrong track. So if they have some relationship with us, then at least that much is there, and later on through that relationship they will come back. Okay? Thank you. So I think we will take a break here, and maybe it's 11:25. So 11:35 we'll meet. Is that okay? In 10 minutes. Thank you very much. Shri Prabhupada ki, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki, Tai Gaur Premanande.